Well, good afternoon, everyone, and a very beautiful afternoon it is. It's nice to get these lovely sunny days, and especially this weekend being Mother's Day weekend. I hope it's as nice tomorrow, and happy Mother's Day to all the mothers out there as of tomorrow. It's looking good now. Well, the last couple of times I spoke, we covered the rise of the prophetic movement in Israel under Samuel, through the heydays of the schools of the prophets and down to the time of Elisha, when Elisha died at about 800 BC. So that's a period from about 1050 BC to 800 BC, about 250 years that we've talked about the schools of the prophets. Now, if you recall, Samuel was raised by Eli, a priest, but the priesthood had become very corrupt. So Samuel saw the degeneration that had happened to the ancient priesthood, and so he sought a way to rejuvenate and restore the true worship of Yahweh in Israel. And so what he did is he reorganized the worship around the schools of the prophets with decentralized worship at various high places throughout the country, instead of centralizing it all at the temple where he witnessed this corrupt priesthood. So at each high place, there was an attendant school of the prophets, and the prophets maintained the pure worship. They taught the people. They ensured that paganisms didn't creep in, and they, for these 250 years, ensured that the proper worship was going on of Yahweh. Now, of course, as we've talked about last time, the great challenge to all this came from Jezebel, who was the queen of Ahab, and she attempted to introduce the worship of the Baal of Tyre, or Baal Melkart, as he was called by the people there. Now, this was a completely foreign pagan religion. There were lots of internal pagan problems within Israel, but this was a completely foreign and would have completely destroyed Israel. So Elijah fought this bitterly, and of course he with the prophets that did survive, defeated Jezebel. Jezebel killed many of the prophets. She compromised many more, but there was a faithful remnant, and together they did defeat Jezebel. And then Elisha carried on the work of Elijah, and under Elisha there was a resurgence of the schools of the prophets, and the true worship of Yahweh continued at the high places, at the decentralized high places. But with the death of Elisha, things changed. We're now on the threshold of the dawn of a whole new era, and it's the era that we call the era of the latter prophets, or the writing prophets. And the first two of these prophets were Amos and Hosea. So today I would like to survey the life and times of these two men, Amos and Hosea. But before getting into that, we maybe should ask the question, why should we care about, why should we study the life and times of any prophet, or these two prophets in particular? Well, there's a very good reason for that, and that reason is that they are called writing prophets. In other words, they wrote things down. They wrote down what they had preached, and we have their actual words. This is very different from the former prophets. The former prophets wrote a lot of things too, but we don't have actual books that they wrote. What we have is books that somebody else used what they wrote, reworked it, assembled it, compiled it, and worked it into the books of Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles. But with the writing prophets, the latter prophets, we have their actual prophecies, the words that they spoke to those people then and there. And of course, because we have their words, as with any time you hear somebody speak, they make allusions to things that are happening in their time. They talk about current events. They talk about things that had just happened, things that were in living memory, or things that were happening right now, or things that they could see happening tomorrow or the day after tomorrow. And so because of all of these contemporary allusions that the prophets make, if we don't understand them, they seem mystical or mysterious or prophetic, and we find all of these things, and we think, ooh, this must have some real deep significance for the end time, because I don't understand it. When you actually understand it and understand what was meant by the prophet, it was simply something that was happening then and there, and it doesn't affect us in that sense. Now, of course, everything that the prophet said, everything that we have recorded, had meaning to those people then and there. They spoke to them, they had a reason to speak to them, and they did speak to them for a purpose, and our job is to try and understand what that purpose was. The prophets did say many things that do relate to the end time, that do relate to the world tomorrow, but without a proper understanding of what they meant then and there at that time when they actually spoke it, it's impossible to discern you know, what really is for the end time, and even if we can, what does it mean? Because we're out in the dark. So we get into all kinds of wild speculations about what the prophets are saying. So let's look a little bit at the historical background that led up to the situation that caused God to bring these writing prophets onto the scene. And we're going to go way back several hundred years here and just bring the history up to where we are. And now, if you look at it, the nation of Israel was born, it flourished, and it went into its decline in an almost perfect historical calm, sort of the antithesis of a perfect storm. There was nothing happening of significance on the world stage during the time that Israel was born, during the times of Solomon and David, and the early part of the monarchy. That's, things started to heat up. But for that period of the establishment and the flourishing, Israel's golden age, there was no challenge. The world was the world scene was calm. There was only Israel. Israel was able to attain that ascendancy because there were no challengers, which obviously you can see the hand of God in that. Now, if you go back to the middle of the second millennium B.C., sort of the period from about 1600 B.C. down to about 1300 B.C., what we've got here is what I call a clash of titans, because this is that there had been these great empires that had grown up in the second millennium, and over this period between 1600 and 1300 B.C., they met each other, they fought, they all settled back into their own borders and just stayed there. They just basically went away. Of course, Egypt had been a great power since about 3000 B.C. They already had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years history by this time. Sumer, which was at least as ancient, maybe more ancient, had been absorbed by Hammurabi's Babylon, which had been defeated by the Hittites. The Hittites came into power in this era out of Asia Minor. They came down, they just defeated Hammurabi and, caused Babylon and all southern Babylonia to sink into a period of quietness, and it really came to a head in 1300 B.C. at the Battle of Kadesh. And then this is one of these turning points in history, one of these battles that, you know, you can really look and say, now here things changed. And what this was when Ramesses II came out of Egypt against the Hittites, and they fought at Kadesh. Kadesh is north of Israel, north of Galilee, not that far, quite near to Damascus, Hamath, those areas there. And it just happened to be where they met. It was a battle between Ramesses II, as I said, of Egypt, and Mutawallis of Hatti. And both sides claimed victory in the battle. They both said, well, we won. It was a rousing victory. And the other was severely defeated. But, of course, neither side won. It was a stalemate, which is witnessed by the fact that right after it happened, they signed a treaty, essentially a non-aggression treaty between the two of them. They drew the line there, went back to their own respective areas, and left essentially Israel all to themselves. So because of this, because all the great powers were resting, or they were gone, they were in quietness, Israel was able to come into existence with only local hassles. We saw previously how the Philistines were a threat to Israel and actually caused Israel to coalesce, but that was the biggest threat Israel had. They didn't have to deal with an Egypt or an Assyria or a Hatti. They only had to deal with local problems. And so the empire of David and Solomon grew up in this vacuum, this power vacuum, and did for a time become the most dominant empire of the Near East. Nobody was there to challenge it, so they were there all by themselves in a state of wealth and power. Now, and then when the empire of David and Solomon broke up under Rehoboam, there was still no great power to come in and absorb everything that had been David's and Solomon's. So what happened then is things just broke up into a bunch of petty states, and you're familiar with them. We're familiar with Phoenicia, centered on Tyre and Sidon. This period from about 900 B.C. down to about 750, this was the time of Phoenicia's great explorations, their great commercial exploits, where they colonized the whole Mediterranean. And this was because of this power vacuum and the big powers. Philistia continued to exist, even though the Israel had defeated them. They existed, but they were no longer a threat to Israel. Edom, Moab, and Ammon, on the east side of the Jordan Valley, again, attained certain status as nations. They had all been part of Solomon and David's empire, but now they became independent petty states, as Judah and Israel were. You had this whole group of petty states that arose out of what had been the empire of David and Solomon. But the one powerful nation that did arise out of this is Aram, or Syria. They call themselves Aram. It's the area where Syria is today, and that's the main cities there were Damascus and Hamath. Damascus is still there. Hamath, I think, is probably just ruins today. Now, the Arameans, the people that formed this really fairly great power, they never really had an empire, but it was an independent great power at the time of around 800, well, starting around 850 BC. We saw some of that last time when we talked about this, but the Aramean people had lived in this area of northwest Mesopotamia for centuries. And it was only at this time, with the absence of David and Solomon's empire, they were able to coalesce. So the Israelites actually recognized their relationship to the Arameans. We can just look at that quickly. If you go to Deuteronomy 26. Because this was the area that Abraham had settled in when he left Ur, was around Haran, and Isaac married Rebekah from this area, so they were related to these Aramean peoples. And here in Deuteronomy 26, verse 5, this is a creed, and they're saying, "You shall make response before the Lord your God. A wandering Aramean was my father, and he went down to Egypt." So the Israelites were required to recognize that the wandering Aramean was their father. Now, is that specifically talking about Abraham? Well, not really. It's talking about the whole general genetic complex of the patriarchs, that they were generally Aramean people. And because they came and they grew up and they were related to these people in this area of northwestern Mesopotamia. But anyway, with the fall of David and Solomon's empire, the Arameans became a very powerful nation, and they put the boots to Israel. They put a lot of pressure on Israel. Let's just look at 1 Kings. We read some of this before, but it's worth looking at again, because this was very much around 800 BC. This is the situation, well, around 850, this is the situation that Israel found themselves in. So 1 Kings 19. Verse 15. He's talking to Elijah here. This is the prophecy where Elijah goes up into Syria and prophesies that Hazael there is going to do great damage to Israel. And the Lord said to him, "Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus. And when you arrive there, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria. And Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel, Elisha to be the prophet. And he who escapes from the sword of Hazael, Jehu shall slay. And he who escapes from the sword of Jehu, Elisha will slay." So again, this is a prophecy. God is sending Elisha to Syria to this guy Hazael and saying, "Hey, you are going to do some great things down the road a little bit." Let's just go over to 2 Kings chapter 8, 2 Kings 8, verse 7. So this is Elisha now going to Damascus. Elisha came to Damascus. Elisha came to Damascus. Ben-Hadad, the king of Assyria, was sick. And when it was told him, "The man of God has come here," the king said to Hazael, so this is the same Hazael, "Take a present with you and go to meet the man of God and inquire of the Lord through him, saying, 'Shall I recover from this sickness?'" So Hazael went to meet him, he's going to see Elisha, and he took a present with him, all the kinds of goods of Damascus, 40 camel loads. And he came and stood before him. He said, "Your son Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, has sent me to you. Shall I recover from this sickness?" So the king was sick. He wants to know from Elisha if he will recover. Elisha said to him, "Go say to him, 'You shall certainly recover, but the Lord has shown me that he shall certainly die.'" And he fixed his gaze and stared at him until he was ashamed, and the man of God wept. Hazael, this is verse 12, Hazael said, "Why does my Lord weep?" He answered, "Because I know the evil that you will do to the people of Israel. You will set on fire their fortresses, you will slay their young men with the sword, and dash in pieces their little ones, and rip up their women with child." So again, this is a prophecy of the evil that Syria was going to in the next few years. So this is about 820, 835, we don't have an exact date for this, this happened, but that's about when Syria did become a dominant power and when they did put a lot of pressure on Israel. The situation is, let me just read something from, this is John Bright's History of Israel. Let's he summarizes the situation a lot better than I can. So this is reading from his book, page 251. So this is after Jehu has gone back and killed the house of Ahab and taken over as king of Israel. And this allowed Hazael a free hand against Israel. What he's actually referring to here is the Assyrians pulling back. Sorry, but in any case, this allowed Hazael a free hand against Israel. Jehu, who I just said had become king with a complete wipeout of all of the family of Ahab, and most of the aristocracy were killed by Jehu. Jehu could not withstand him, and soon had lost the whole of Transjordan south to the Moabite frontier. So everything east of the Jordan River was taken by the Arameans on the Arnon. His son, Jehoahaz, so this is Jehu's son, the next king, fared even worse. Beaten and conquered, he was allowed by Hazael a bodyguard of only 10 chariots and 50 horsemen, plus a police force of 10,000 foot. And recall, Ahab had mustered 2,000 chariots at the Battle of Karkar. So three kings ago, Israel was able to put 2,000 chariots into battle. Now Hazael allowed Jehoahaz to have only, whatever they said, their 10 chariots. Aramean forces also thrust down the coastal plain into Philistia, besieged and took Gath, and were deterred from invading Judah only by the receipt of an enormous tribute. As for Israel, with all her territory in Transjordan, in Esdraelon, along the sea, and presumably also in Galilee, in Aramean control, she had been reduced to the status of a dependency of Damascus. So all this in two kings, really. Since Ahab had been a powerful king, he was wiped out by Jehu. Jehu and his son were completely defeated by Aram, reduced to a tiny little state that was a dependency on Damascus. All the territory of Israel was now controlled by Damascus. Now, Judah did not suffer so badly because they paid this tribute to Hazael and he left them alone. His main concern was Israel, because Israel was the strongest of the powers there. Now, the other strong powers that arose at this time, or had been growing at this time, was the nation called Urartu, which is north of Aram and north of Assyria, in the mountains between the Black and Caspian Seas. And they were in the mountains, it was hard to attack them. But they became very powerful, so powerful that Assyria could not defeat both them and Aram. And so Assyria, even though they'd grown by this time to be a strong nation, they didn't have enough strength to actually take out Urartu and take out Aram. So they spent from about 800 BC down to about 750 BC. They were constantly this fight went on. Eventually they did take out Aram, but for those 50 years, they put a lot of pressure on Aram, and that is what led to the situation in Israel that's of interest to us, because Aram was now forced to use all of its strength to fight the Assyrians. And so it left Israel and Judah alone to prosper and come into a period of relative prosperity. So that's what we want to talk about now, is what's actually happening in Israel. So the period we've been talking about here is basically from about 850 through 750 BC. In Israel in that time, there were four kings, as I've mentioned, Jehu and Jehoahaz, and then Joash was king there, and then Jeroboam too is the king that we're mostly interested in this era, because he and his contemporary king of Judah were the ones that brought great prosperity back to Israel. Now, in Judah in the time, there were only three kings, in the period, Joash, Amaziah, and Azariah, or Uzziah, he's called both names. You recall Joash was the little baby that was saved from Athaliah's purge by his aunt, and he was put on the throne at age 8, I believe. He had a long reign and was a relatively good king, but it was the last king in the time, Azariah or Uzziah. Azariah and Jeroboam reigned more or less contemporaneously, from about 790s down to 750, 740 BC. So they had very long reigns. They were both very able rulers. They brought great prosperity to Judah and Israel, but only because of, again, the world situation. Assyria was strong, but had two strong states to fight against. They had to give all their attention to Assyria. Judah and Israel down below were left alone to have this prosperity. So let's quickly look at some of the things that happened. Let's go to 2 Kings 14. No, 13 first. 2 Kings 13. 2 Kings 13:25. So then Joash, the son of Jehoahaz, so the father of Jeroboam, took again from Ben-Hadad, the son of Hazael, the cities which he had taken from Jehoahaz and his father in war. So this is Jeroboam's father now actually went over across the Jordan, recovered the Israelite territory on the east side of the Jordan. Going ahead to chapter 14, verse 7. This is talking about, this is in Judah. This is Amaziah of Judah. And I'm just quoting this out of context here, but the point is the fact that he was able to do this. So Amaziah, king of Judah, killed 10,000 Edomites in the Valley of Salt and took Selah by a storm. So now we have Judah expanding. Judah is now going over into Edom, conquering Edom, making Edom a dependency now of Judah. Verse 22, skipping ahead to verse 22, this is still Amaziah. He built Elat and restored it to Judah. Now, Elat is, if you recall, that's the port right on the top of the Gulf of Aqaba, Ezion Geber, it's sometimes otherwise called, and there's still a city there today. But it's, of course, an important port because it's a southern access to all of Africa for ships and for caravans coming across land to this port. You now have all of Africa open to you. It's a very important port. Verse 25, this is now talking about Jeroboam. Verse 25, he restored the border of Israel from the entrance of Hamath as far as the Sea of the Arabah. And so now, not only is the territory on the east side of Jordan been recovered, but he's pushed all the way up to Hamath, which is essentially the border where Solomon's empire had been. And verse 28, now the rest of the acts of Jeroboam and all that he did and his might, how he fought, how he recovered for Israel Damascus and Hamath. So it would seem that Jeroboam even had a hegemony over the two cities, these two great cities of the Arameans. He brought them, I don't think they were ever part of Israel, but at least they became dependencies of Israel. Okay, let's go ahead to 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 26. This whole chapter is about Uzziah. 2 Chronicles 26. And we'll start in verse 1 and read, well, it looks like 11 verses or so here, and then a couple more verses. All the people of Judah took Uzziah, who was 16 years old, and made him king instead of his father Amaziah. He built Elat, and restored it to Judah after the king slept with his fathers. That would be Amaziah's father. He's talking about Joash there. No, Amaziah. This is it. We're talking about Uzziah here. So Uzziah was 16 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 52 years in Jerusalem, very long reign. His mother's name was Jechaliah. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that his father Amaziah had done. He set himself to seek God in the days of Zechariah, who instructed him in the fear of God. As long as he sought the Lord, God made him prosper. Now, we get into some of his exploits here. He went out and made war on the Philistines, and broke down the wall of Gath, the wall of Yabne, and the wall of Ashdod. So now he's expanding to the west. He's taking out the Philistine cities and bringing those under the control of Judah. And he built the cities in the territory of Ashdod and elsewhere among the Philistines. And now there's Jewish cities, Israelite cities, in what had been the Philistine territory. God helped him against the Philistines and against the Arabs that dwelt in Gerbal. I'm not sure where that is, probably somewhere to the east. And against the Meunites. Now, this, one of the commentators suggests that they actually should be Moabites, because it's not clear who else it would be. And then it goes right on to talk about the Ammonites. That probably should be Moabites. The Ammonites made tribute to Uzziah, and his fame spread even to the border of Egypt, where he became very strong. So he was powerful enough that Egypt was looking at him and saying, oh, this guy Uzziah is starting to do some things. We better watch what he does. Moreover, Uzziah built towers in Jerusalem at the corner gate and at the gate, at the valley gate and at the angle, and fortified them. And he built towers in the wilderness and hewed out many cisterns, for he had large herds, both in the Shephelah and in the plain. The Shephelah is that sort of low rolling hill country on the south, southwest of Judah, and it's still today a very prosperous farming area. And he, both in the Shephelah and in the plain, and he had farmers and vine dressers in the hills and in the fertile lands, for he loved the soil. Moreover, Uzziah had an army of soldiers fit for war. Then it goes on and talks about the soldiers a little bit. Stepping ahead to verse 15. In Jerusalem, he made engines. He made engines invented by skillful men to be on the towers and the corners to shoot arrows and great stones. And his fame spread far, for he was marvelously helped till he was strong. So he did a lot of things. He strengthened Jerusalem, strengthened the army, expanded the territory, and brought great prosperity. Again, I'll just read from John Bright here. He summarizes this period very well. So now the quote from Bright before was the period when Aram was controlling Israel and had their, if you will, their heel on Israel's neck. Now the shoe's on the other foot, and Israel has attained some measure of success and wealth. By the mid-8th century, so we're talking about 750 B.C., the dimensions of Israel and Judah together lacked but little of being as great as those of the Empire of Solomon, since full advantage seems to have been taken of the favorable position in which the country found itself, a prosperity unknown since Solomon ensued. The two states being at peace with each other, and the major trade routes up and down Transjordan into northern Arabia, along the coastal plain, into the hinterland from the Phoenician ports, all once more passed through Israelite-held territory. Tolls from caravans, together with the free interchange of goods, poured wealth into both countries. There was probably a revival of Red Sea trade, as there was of the copper industry of the Arabah. It is almost certain that Tyre, not yet at the end of her great period of commercial expansion, was again drawn into the program by treaty, as in the days of Solomon and the Amorites. This resulted in a prosperity such as no living Israelite could remember. The splendid buildings and costly ivory inlays of Phoenicia or Damascene origin unearthed at Samaria show that Amos did not exaggerate the luxury that Israel's upper classes enjoyed. Judah was equally prosperous. Population in both countries probably reached its greatest density in the 8th century, with many towns overflowing their walls. The chronicler's description of Uzziah's efforts, which we just read, efforts to develop the economic and agricultural resources of his country, especially in the Negev, is corroborated by the fact that the Negev was more intensely settled at this time than at any other time in Israel's history. Archaeology also reveals that industries of various kinds, example weaving and dyeing, flourished remarkably. In short, as the kingdoms of Israel and Judah reached the middle of the second century of their existence, they found themselves better off than they had ever been before. It was superficially, at least, a time of great optimism and of great confidence in the promises of God for the future. And that brings us to the prophets. Now, we briefly saw last time we spoke that how the schools of the prophets had flourished, but they did fall under the sway of Jezebel. They did fall under hard times, and many of the prophets were corrupted. Well, many were killed, but many were corrupted and went over to not serving God properly. Let's look at, going back a little bit here, 2 Kings 14. The first three verses here are talking about the ascension of Amaziah, and in verse 4, this condemnation is raised against him. But the high places were not removed. The people still sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And these were the very high places that Samuel had used to promote correct worship of God, the very high places that the schools of the prophets had been using to teach the people, and now they were considered corrupt. And we saw the beginnings of that back when Elisha was still alive. If you go back to 1 Kings 22, verse 5. So this is Jehoshaphat said to the king of Israel, "Inquire first of the word of the Lord." Then the king of Israel gathered the prophets together, about 400 men, and said to them, "Shall I go to battle?" They said, "Go up, for the Lord will give it into the hand of the king." So these were prophets. These weren't prophets of Baal. These were prophets that claimed to be prophets of Yahweh. And they're telling the king, "Yeah, go and do what you want to do." Jehoshaphat asked if there's another prophet. So he recognized that these prophets were simply sycophants doing the will of the king. They weren't representing God's will. So they went and found Micaiah and got him to comment on the situation. That's the next few verses. Skipping ahead to verse 10. Now the king of Israel and Jehoshaphat, king of Judah, were sitting on their thrones, arrayed in their robes at the threshing floor at the entrance of the gate of Samaria, and all the prophets were prophesying before them. And Zedekiah, the son of Chenaiah, made for himself horns of iron and said, "Thus says the Lord, with these you shall push the Syrians until they are destroyed." And all the prophets prophesied so. So we have prophets now that were corrupted. They'd ceased to serve Yahweh. They now were simply functionaries of the king, doing his will, bidding him whatever he wanted to hear. And that's why the high places became corrupt, because they were no longer teaching God's way. Similarly, this is an incident with Elisha. Similarly, over in 2 Kings 3. 2 Kings 3:11. Jehoshaphat, is there no prophet? Again, Jehoshaphat wants to have a true prophet of Yahweh. So it is. Is there no prophet of the Lord here through whom we may inquire of the Lord or Yahweh? Then one of the king's servants answered, "Elisha, the son of Shaphat, is here, who poured water on the hands of Elijah." Jehoshaphat said, "The word of the Lord is with him." Verse 13, Elisha said to the king of Israel, "What have I to do with you? Go to the prophets of your father and the prophets of your mother." So even before Elisha was dead, we see this corruption of the schools of the prophets, where they became no more than just functionaries of the state. Now that's unfortunately kind of a natural progression in institutions that are born out of idealism and integrity. They last for a while, and they're successful if there is enough idealism and integrity. And you know, as the schools of the prophets did, they last for a while, but they tend to become corrupt. And we've seen that in certain organization that we used to participate with. But it's true in society, too. As society becomes more and more corrupt, more people are not interested in integrity. They're not interested in principles. They're not interested in morals. And so things go into a decline. And so that's what happens with the prophets. In the north, they became functionaries strictly of the monarchy. And in the south, they tended to more become absorbed by the temple and the priests. And, of course, the temple and the priests were developing their own problems, but to the monarchy as well. Okay, so let's get now down to Amos and Hosea. So let's look first at Amos. Amos was the first of the writing prophets. He was the very first of these prophets to come along and preach God's will, and we have his written record of what he said. Now, we don't know very much about Amos. We have just his book to go on. It seems that Amos probably had a very short prophetic career. His whole prophetic career may well have been just one mission. He was from the south in Judah, and he may have just once in his life gone up to the northern kingdom and preached essentially what we have here, and then he went back, because it doesn't seem he did much more than that. But chapter 1, verse 1 of Amos. The words of Amos, who was among the shepherds of Tekoa. So Tekoa is a little town about 10 miles south of Jerusalem, concerning what he saw, which he saw concerning Israel in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash. So he says he spoke only during the period, but this period of great prosperity, probably towards the end of it, probably about 760 B.C. is when he spoke. And let's just skip over to chapter 7. This is the only other little piece of information that we have about his life. Chapter 7, verse 12. Now, Amasai, this Amasai is a priest at Bethel. And Amasiah said to Amos, O seer, go, flee away to the land of Judah and eat bread there and prophesy there, but never again prophesy in Bethel, for it is the king's sanctuary and it is a temple of the kingdom. So this was obviously not a priest who was serving God. This was obviously a priest serving the king. He considered the sanctuary there to be the king's sanctuary, not God's in any way. Amos answered Amasiah, I am no prophet. And again, the writing prophets had nothing good to say about the institutional prophets. The schools of the prophets, as far as they were concerned, were utterly corrupt, bankrupt, a defunct institution. So Amos roundly says, I am no prophet. He had nothing to do with any of the prophetic schools, nor a prophet's son, but I am a herdsman and a dresser of sycamore trees. So essentially he was a farmer. He kept animals and dressed trees. The Lord took me from following the flock, and the Lord said to me, go prophesy to my people Israel. Which is what he did, and we have his words, and that's about all we know about him. Let's quickly then look at Hosea and see what we can glean about the life of Hosea. Now, the first three chapters of Hosea contain an awful lot of very interesting information about Hosea's life, his family life, if you will, and I've covered it in the past. I'm not going to dwell on it particularly now. To say that it's there, we may come back to it another time. But let's just read again chapter 1, verse 1 to get the time setting of Hosea. The word of the Lord that came to Hosea, the son of Beeri, in the days of Uzziah, Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, the son of Joash, king of Israel. Now, it seems that Hosea was a northerner. We don't know exactly where he was born, but most people from the book feel that, yes, he was a natural Israelite living in the northern part of the country, and he prophesied there to them. He had a long career, as you see by the list of kings he gives, going from approximately 755 B.C. down to probably 725 B.C., so probably 30 years he prophesied for, he worked. And though he worked in the north, he probably ended his career in the south, probably when the northern kingdom fell, he went to the south. And that's why he references the Judean kings more than the northern kings, because when he put his book together, it's probably he was in the south and the north was gone. And so there's things in the book that clearly look like they were written from the perspective of the south, even though the majority of the prophecy was originally spoken to the north. 1 verse 4a. First part of the verse 4. And the Lord said to him, this is to Hosea, call his name Jezreel, that's his son, for a little while, and I will punish the house of Jehu for the blood of Jezreel. Now that, punish the blood of Jehu, that's an allusion going back to the purge of Jehu on Ahab and the bloodlust that Jehu exhibited when he wiped out Ahab. He didn't just get Ahab and Jezebel, he got everybody. Everybody who was anybody in Israel was murdered by Jehu, and it was never really forgiven. He didn't need to have that much excess. And the fact that he says this is referencing the house of Jehu, this means that this prophecy was actually given when Jeroboam was still the king, because Jeroboam was the last king of the house of Jehu. Let's look at 5 verse 13. Again, remember I talked about contemporary allusions. This is what I'm trying to just point out here. A couple of things that, you know, if you don't look at the history and what was happening in history, these things seem enigmatic and strange. So let's go to chapter 5, verse 13. When Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah his wound, now recall this is poetry, so the translation attempts to some degree to follow the poetic form of the original. So when Ephraim saw his sickness and Judah saw his wound, you can supply saw, that's the parallelism in the poetry, then Ephraim went to Assyria, and by parallelism, Judah sent to the great king. So, you know, what does that mean? What are we talking about here? Well, let's go and look at the historical situation. Let's go over back to 2 Kings, verse 15, or chapter 15, sorry. 2 Kings chapter 15. Just keep your place there in Hosea. We'll be back there. So 2 Kings chapter 15. And what verse do I want? Verse 19. Pul, who was otherwise known as Tiglath-Pileser, The king of Assyria came up against the land, this is the northern land of Israel, and Menahem gave Pul 1,000 talents of silver that he might help him to confirm his hold of the royal power. So this is one of the last kings of the northern kingdom. He actually engaged the Assyrians with money to help him stay on the throne. So that's the first part of the verse, back in Hosea. Ephraim went to Assyria. And then skipping ahead and back in 2 Kings to chapter 20. Chapter 20, verse 13. And Hezekiah welcomed him and showed him all. Let's just go back to verse 12. At that time, Merodach-Baladan, son of Baladan, king of Babylon, sent envoys with letters and a present to Hezekiah, for he heard that Hezekiah was sick. And Hezekiah welcomed him and showed him all his treasure house, the silver, the gold, the spices, the precious oils in his armory, and all that was found in his storehouse. And there was nothing in his house or in all his realm that Hezekiah did not show them. That's the second part of the illusion. Judah sent to the great king. The great king here is the king of Babylon, Merodach-Baladan. So, again, a verse that if you don't look at the history, it seems, what's happening here? Is this there's some great end-time fulfillment to this? Well, no, it's just something that happened then and there, and Hosea is referring to it within the context of his prophecy. Now, going back a few verses in this same chapter, chapter 5, verses 8 through 12. Blow the horn in Gibeah, the trumpet in Ramah. Sound the alarm at Bet Aven. Tremble, O Benjamin. Ephraim shall become a desolation in the day of punishment among the tribes of Israel. I declare what is sure. The princes of Judah have become like those who remove the landmark. Upon them I will pour out my wrath like water. Ephraim is oppressed, crushed in judgment, because he was determined to go after vanity. Therefore I am like a moth to Ephraim and a dry rot to the house of Judah. Okay, what's happening here? Well, this is a clear reference to what's usually called the Syrio-Ephraimite War, a time when the northern kingdom got together with the Assyrians, paid the money, and they came and attacked the southern kingdom. Let's just go back to 2 Kings 16 and read about that. Now I lost my place. 2 Kings 16:5. Then Rezin, king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, king of Israel, came up and waged war on Jerusalem, and they besieged Ahaz but could not conquer him. So again, this is a period of war between the northern kingdom and Syria attacking the southern kingdom. And this is what this prophecy had its origin in. Hosea was preaching to the people and saying, look at this war. You used to be strong and prosperous. Now you're fighting with each other. Israel is dry rot, or Judah's falling apart. Moths are destroying them, and all because of the sins of the nation. All through this period, recall that how I talked about Egypt having been such a great power, and then there was this battle of Kadesh, and the Egyptians sort of sank back into their country. Now, in Egypt, they were very protected because it's very difficult for anybody to attack them, so they did survive very well. There was tremendous wealth in Egypt itself. They just didn't have the political will to actually go out and do anything. They still officially claimed all of Canaan as part of their empire, right up until the end, basically, until the Assyrians marched into Egypt. They still claimed that all of Canaan was part of their empire, but it really never was. Soon after that battle of Kadesh, when Israel arose, certainly by the time of David and Solomon, Egypt had no effective control or influence in Canaan. But they kept meddling. They never stopped meddling. Whenever an Egyptian king felt like he could do something in Canaan, he did, and he's always up there stirring up trouble. And there's lots of allusions to that here in Hosea. Let's just look at a couple of those. 7:11. Ephraim is like a dove, silly and without sense, calling to Egypt, going to Assyria. So that was what was happening at the time. There were these two powers, Assyria, a real threat, but Egypt constantly up there stirring up trouble. So there were these two factions in Israel, one saying, yeah, let's get Egypt to help us. They'll defeat the Assyrians. And the more realistic people saying, no, the Assyrians are the trouble. They're the problem. Chapter 9, verse 6. For behold, they are going to Assyria. Egypt shall gather them. Memphis, one of the major cities of Egypt, shall bury them. Nettles shall possess their precious things of silver. So again, Egyptian entanglements. Chapter 12, verse 1. Ephraim herds the wind and pursues the east wind all day long. They multiply falsehood and violence. They make a bargain with Assyria, and oil is carried to Egypt. So again, going down to Egypt, trying to get help, but Egypt couldn't help anybody. They didn't have the political will. So again, this is just a brief, what I've touched on in Amos and Hosea. Of course, we haven't even touched their message at all here. We'll talk about that another time, but I did want to sort of bring the history all into perspective and get down to these first two of the prophets and see how the history and how their life and times is important and significant. So in conclusion then, we have surveyed an extremely fascinating period of history. It's the period of the formation and the decline of Israel. It started out when Israel was first forming a world of superpowers, which clashed, and then it broke down into a world of petty kingdoms, in which Israel for a time was a regional superpower. But Israel quickly disintegrated when the new superpower, Assyria, emerged. We're seeing the beginnings of that here. And God called the prophets to this situation. The end of Israel was in sight. The sins of Israel were rampant. And that's when God chose to call the writing prophets who chronicled the fall of Israel, and the former prophets had chronicled the rise of Israel. At the end of this day, these prophets came to Israel, cited her for her sins. God also had another purpose for the prophets, the latter prophets, which was to secure a remnant of Israel so that the true faith could go on. But from our perspective, the most important thing is that they wrote down their prophecies, they wrote what they spoke, and we have recorded their actual words. And that's what I like to refer to, that collection of these prophetic words, as the second great outpouring of revelation from God.